welcome to another session with Betty and Paul Picard. Tonight's session is entitled "Sincerity is Not Enough." Subtitle is "Politics as Reconciliation." And this is part of our ongoing effort to blend our respective academic disciplines. Betty's on the faculty in social work at Florida State University, and I'm on the faculty in political science there. And where our fields intersect, as I said recently, we think one finds the points of serious Christian concern. Now, the Holden Village didn't invite us to come across the country in order to be the voice of your conscience, or in order to be a kind of folk to tell you infallibly anything at all about what we're talking about what's right and wrong, or what the Christian response to politics is. But I think they did invite us to come with the hope that we would say some things that would help all of us to see these problems in a little different way than we see them without talking about them. So the object isn't conversion, happily, because I've gotten a distinct impression last week in this that there's very little conversion going on. Nor is the object, I think a lot more of this goes on, nor is the object to preach to the converted, just to reinforce each other's preconceptions, but rather let us hope that by trickling away at these old insoluble ideas, wrestling with these internal problems of social responsibility and Christian responsibility, we won't solve the problems, but we will come to understand them better, and we'll come to understand better our own posture with regard to them, come to see better what we stand for, what we represent, that is, come to define ourselves better. So that's what the whole series is about, I think, in tonight's session in particular. Let me share with you, in the spirit of Jim White, who is a walking thesaurus of familiar quotations and unfamiliar ones, let me share with you three that have helped to shape my thinking about public policy. I wrote one of them down, so I'll get it correctly. The others I'm going to try and do from memory, which isn't very good. The first is from Pericles. Well, not really from Pericles, but from what Thucydides said about Pericles. And I guess some people think maybe Thucydides, the historian, put his own words into Pericles' mouth. But since I can't give it to you in Greek, I'll give you Benjamin Jowett's English translation. It goes something close to this. This is the time of the Peloponnesian Wars, and a big funeral for the soldiers killed. And Pericles says, on behalf of the people of Athens, "We alone regard a man who takes no interest in public affairs not as a harmless, but as a useless character. And if few of us are originators, we're all sound judges of a policy. We alone regard a man who takes no interest in public affairs not as a harmless, but as a useless character." Certainly, Americans couldn't say that today, could they? We Americans don't mind at all people who take no interest in public affairs. But Pericles represents here what I would call the civic person. And one of the major tensions I see in our world and in our profession of our religious faith is the tension between our identity as civic people and our private identities, our search for privacy, independence. The second quote is the one I'll get accurately because I just went and copied it down. There's one you'll recognize both the beginning and the ending of it. Perhaps you didn't realize it was all one sentence. And the middle part of the sentence really helps to nail down the point. No man is an island entire of itself. Every man is a piece of the continent, a part of the main. If a clod be washed away by the sea, Europe is blessed, as well as if a promontory were, as well as if a manor of thy friends or of thine own were. Any man's death diminishes me, because I am involved in mankind, and therefore never send to know for whom the bell tolls, it tolls for thee. The connection between these two quotations, I hope you recognize, is again the emphasis on the civic person. That John Donne, this early 17th century quote, is saying that he is not an independent person, that he cannot go his own way by himself, but he is a part of the community, a member of the community. And his existence is defined, at least in part, by that membership. And again, note the contradiction between Dunn's point and the prevailing American way, the American cowboy myth especially, which likes to pretend that a person can be an island. I saw someone, I don't know if she's here this evening or not, but I saw someone this week walking around with a copy of Ayn Rand's The Fountainhead. And if you were looking for an author that you could quote back to me in contradiction to John Donne, Ayn Rand would be a good one, and Fountainhead was written as a contradiction of this point of view, of Dunn's point of view. Ayn Rand says that the hero is an island, uncommitted, unbeholden to the community, entitled to live by his own law. Yeah, you have to pardon these masculine pronouns in here, but when I'm quoting these other people, they wrote long ago, when you're stuck with their language, where Dunn said casually, "No man is an island." Today, we can read it, "No person is an island," or "People are not islands entire unto themselves." And that notion just as has permeated my thinking about politics. The third quotation comes from a man named Leon Blum, who was the first socialist and the first Jewish premier of France back in the 1930s. And he was an extraordinary person in many ways. But both as a socialist and as a Jew, you can imagine what his status was when the Germans took over control of France in the early part of World War II. So they slapped the man into prison and put him on trial. And you got to understand, on trial in a Nazi court, it was just a kangaroo court, not an honest court in any sense of the word. His guilt was foreordained. There was no possibility that he could exonerate himself. But it turned out that even though it was just window dressing, just a show trial, his defense was so eloquent, he was so effective, that they just stopped the trial. Just never finished the trial. Just locked him up anyway. So he's sitting in prison. Now, you know, lots of these Pollyannish sayings that we love to quote are just easy for people like us to quote. We sit here in these beautiful surroundings, enjoying this great opportunity to withdraw from the rest of the world and share each other's company. That's just a wonderful experience for us. And it's easy for us to say grand things. It's easy for us to hold out grand ideals. But this quote I'm about to share with you comes from a prisoner, a political prisoner, at the point in the war where his prospects were the dimmest, long before the tide of the war had shifted against the Germans. He smuggled this work out of prison. The French title, I'm embarrassed to try and say anything in French in public, and particularly embarrassed to say it was a piece of word going, but the French title of the book is A l'Echelle Humaine, and the English translation of it, this is very, very typical, where the French use the word humaine, the English translation uses the word mankind. So here, Bloom didn't say mankind. He said something that I would prefer to translate as humanity. And I won't get the quotation exactly right. I haven't used it now for many years. But it goes something like that, like this. Let man keep his gaze fixed on his goal. Let him keep faith in his destiny. Let him not shrink from using the strength that is his. And in times of anxiety and discouragement, let all his thought be for all humanity. In times of anxiety and discouragement, think about sitting in that Nazi controlled prison at the high tide of the Nazi aggression. And his thought was a commitment to all humanity. And these three little statements all seem to me, have long seemed to me, to add up to a legitimate commitment for believing people, for caring people, for loving people, to the whole community. It makes participation in politics a sign of responsibility, not a sign of corruption. I know that the word politics just has a bad connotation for many of us. A lot of people, when we told them we were coming here, and a lot of people after we got here, want to know how we could talk about politics and religion, or how we could talk about politics and religious settings. They're so opposite each other. Well, this evening I want to try and develop the thesis that they're opposite, all right, but that the happier side of the two is the politics side of it. And so, as some of you said last Tuesday when I started the presentation, I'm trying to stack the cards. And that's why I picked out those quotations. And as you know, you could pick out some other quotations to make the opposite point. I've used the word community a couple of times. I want to explore that very briefly and then go to still a fourth statement. I can't make it a quotation, but the word community, you'll recognize, is essentially the same word as the word communication and as the word communion. it's a community, it's a collection of people who are in communication with each other. And we can give it a kind of mystical dimension by pushing it from communication to communion, so that if the people are in communion with each other, they make up a really respectable kind of community. And it seemed to me it's in community, in communion with each other, that we can best fulfill our calling to be human. It's my thesis this evening that we're not called to be hermits. As far as I can understand, there are very few hermits in history. Robinson Crusoe is a fictitious character, not a genuine one. And Thoreau, who pretends to be a hermit for a while, only does it for a very short while, and he only does it on the strength of the education he got from the community. And he belongs very much to the community. There's no way he can go out there to Walden Pond by himself. He took his books with him, but he also borrowed an axe when he went. I always thought that line that I borrowed an axe just undercut everything else the man had to say about being an island entirely unto himself, about being self-sufficient. For me, the axe is just symbolic for all the other things he borrowed, but especially his education. The fourth source I turned to is a book, unfortunately not in our library here, by Alan Simpson, called Puritanism in Old and New England. And what I wish I could do would be to recite the last page of the book for you, but I can't. I can perhaps give you the flavor of it, however. The whole book has been examining the Puritans' role in both England and New England. And Simpson finally wants to share his conclusion with us. He said he could cite the Puritan who said, "What is morally wrong can never be politically right." But he said, instead of citing that, he'll cite something else. Is that all right? You follow? That's a little professorial joke. He does cite it, and that's why I could repeat it to him. But he says, instead of citing it, he'll cite a sermon that was delivered around the turn of the century. And this is where I wish I could repeat this sermon for you. But the sermon goes something like this. The preacher is extolling the virtues of Oliver Cromwell. And he said it was just great when Cromwell went into Parliament. And he said, pointing to one man, "There sits a taker of bribes." And pointing to another man, "There sits a man whose religion is a farce." And pointing to another, "There sits a man whose life is impure and foul." And then, in the name of Almighty God, broke up the Parliament. It is that most admirable act, and the preacher at the turn of the century here in America said he wished that some new kind of Oliver Cromwell could rise up in the American Congress and do the same thing. Now, the author, Alan Simpson, says that this finally represents the Puritans at their worst. This is distilled out of the Puritan position. And he says what it is, it reflects their attempt to impose their moral values on the rest of society, to make their morals a test for public office. And to turn politics, which Alan Simpson says, ought to be the art of reconciliation, into a moral crusade. So tonight I'm arguing in favor of politics as reconciliation, and I'm arguing against the moral crusade. Now, when Betty and I first wrote off to Larry Rasmussen, the program director for this summer, with this proposal, it seemed like a reasonable proposal to me. But then, a couple months later, Khomeini in Iran presided over this, or gave his benediction to the holding of the American embassy hostage, you know, a kind of crime in international law which not even Hitler committed. I don't think Attila the Hun ever abused the immunity of diplomats, of ambassadors. And so I thought, oh, well, there it goes. There's no argument left. Everybody will see now what I've been trying to say for these last many years about the evils of sincerity in public life. Everyone will agree with me. But of course, it's better to have politics, better to have politicians making deals, making compromises, rather than standing on eternal principle, rather than conducting a moral crusade. So I thought, poof, there goes that whole topic. But after I got here and started talking with many of you and some of your predecessors, I discovered that the evidence of Khomeini, his rabid, dedicated, sincere, I suppose sincere, but certainly a very, very strong, committed religious figure, that evidence, it doesn't make any difference. We come to life at our age with our own perceptions, and what doesn't fit, we don't see. We filter everything through the screen of our previous education. And so I gather that people are still in favor of that theory and still negatively critical of politics. How many of you would claim, overtly, consciously claim to be mind readers? Could you say, I am a mind reader, I can tell what's going on in someone else's mind? We don't any of us claim that, do we? And yet, when we bring the test of sincerity to politics, this is exactly what we do. And in doing it, we give a tremendous and a tremendously unfair advantage to the best actor. And in our society, our culture, this means the politician who can look a cold piece of ground optical glass, the television lens, directly straight on, without flinching, without flickering, without any of those telltale signs of dishonesty. And by looking that lens straight on, persuade the people looking at a two-dimensional image all over the country that here is a man who talks straight. Here is a man who speaks from the heart. Here is a man who is sincere, who has the courage of his convictions, who tells it like he believes it, tells it like he sees it, tells it like it is. What an unfair advantage to give the person who has that particular kind of acting ability. Uh, How many of you saw the movie King's Row? Some of you just would have seen it on late night television, but some of us saw it when it was brand new. Did any of you see it? You remember? Oh, I'm sorry you didn't see it. It's a fine. It's the best movie Ronald Reagan ever made. The closest he came to real success as a top-run movie actor, cinema actor. And in the story, some of you know the story, he's playing the part of a very attractive young man from the wrong side of the tracks who's courting the small-town doctor's daughter. And the small-town doctor doesn't like it one bit. And the boy, young man's in an automobile accident, and the doctor had a chance to get at him, and the doctor cuts off his legs. And then Ronald Reagan wakes up in bed finally. You can see him lying in the hospital bed. The sheet, you know, his body goes down to just below his hips, and that's all. And the sheet is just flat. And Reagan wakes up and he says, where's the rest of me? Just one of the most moving, one of the most dramatic, one of the most persuasive, convincing moments in many, many years of seeing movies for me. Now, I'm sorry, I'm just telling it to you because I wish you'd seen it and you could remember it. You'd say, yeah, the guy can't do it. And so when Westinghouse hired him to give a political speech, it didn't matter that he'd been an active Democrat. It didn't matter that he'd been a leader, a president of his labor union. Westinghouse wanted him to give a good Westinghouse kind of political speech. He gave it, and it was so convincing that today he is the leading candidate for the presidency. And people really believe Ronald Reagan. Well, I'm not just picking on Reagan. President Carter had to be able to do the same thing, didn't he, 4 years ago? He had to be able to persuade people that he'd been born again, that he had found Jesus. And I know all kinds of people, especially other people who have found Jesus, who are moved by this. Now, I cannot tell you, because I also am not a mind reader, that Carter wasn't sincere. I can't tell you that Reagan isn't sincere. I can just tell you that we cannot know. There is no way for us to know who is sincere. And if we use sincerity as an element of evaluating our public figures, then we make the mistake of giving this unfair advantage to the best actors. But that's just an operational problem with sincerity. But I hope you see I've tried to give you a deeper problem with it, a substantive problem with it, and that is that sincere people in public life are very dangerous people. Now, excuse me, in private, I've got to confess that I believe in sincerity. When somebody wants to go to bed with you, you want to know whether they're sincere or not.
And that seems perfectly appropriate. So don't misunderstand what I'm saying about sincerity. Sincerity is very nice in private relations and personal relations. And certainly we must try to evaluate it in people we deal with personally and directly. But I'm not in public affairs. Sincere people are deadly. I don't think, until Truman came along, that there was a more sincere politician in the 20th century than Adolf Hitler. Now, again, I could be wrong. Hitler might have just been something all the rest of it. He might have said, way down deep in his little heart of hearts, this is the biggest joke I ever pulled on anybody. And I got all these millions of people believing. It could be. I don't think so. I'm willing to give Hitler his sincerity. I think he really hated Jews.